The following teaching is part 3 in a 6-part series by Dr. Ken Boa, titled Great Books Everyone Should Know, Series 3.
William Law, and specifically this book, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life, had a profound impact on what was known as the Great Evangelical Revival that maybe dated from about 1738 and had a powerful impact on England. And this particular book, probably more than any other, had a shape and a bearing that affected the lives of so many. This book, which was published in 1728, is a book that deals in practical ways, as we'll see, with the issues of what it means to live in a way that's absolutely consistent and authentic, in ways that are absolutely compelling. And his desire in this book was to not simply rouse our feelings, but more to convince our minds of the absurdity of believing one thing and of doing another. So that becomes a major theme in this book. And he'll use even a sort of grim form of humor and interesting characters to come about this plan from a wide variety of angles. Law was born in 1686 in Kingscliff in Northamptonshire, where his father was a grocer. He was raised in the high church tradition and as of the more old-fashioned type, rather than among Methodists or evangelicals. He was a high church Anglican who went to Emmanuel College in Cambridge, graduated in 1708, and became a fellow of the society there in the year 1711. In that same year, he received holy orders. But he made no secret of his Jacobite proclivities. And what happened then was the death of the Queen, of Queen Anne, brought matters to a crisis. And he refused to take oaths of allegiance because of the coming then of the George I, the accession of the Hanoverians brought him to a real crisis of conscience, specifically in the year 1714. And he became what was called a non-juror, which means that those who refused to take an oath of allegiance, which were required of university teachers and also of parish ministers, meant a great sacrifice for his career. It meant then that he could no longer officiate in a regular way in parish ministry. As a consequence, he became an inmate of the family of Mr. Edward Gibbon, who was the grandfather of the historian, and became really the tutor, a domestic tutor to the second Edmund Gibbon, the father of the man who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And so he was involved, as often took place, as a family tutor, and he was certainly a man who sought to be consistent in his practice and in a consistent way with his life. And ultimately he moved to Kingscliff again and there formed schools and almshouses and so forth, and created a system there of charity and of good works, particularly focusing on the needs of the poor and also with children, with whom he took great pleasure. Although he was a fairly severe kind of personality, nevertheless he took great delight in working with those who were despondent and overlooked, and also with children. Now, it was the fashion in those days to attend church. Church attendance wasn't the problem at this particular time in history. And furthermore, objections to Christianity were being soundly and adequately answered, and the objectors were being fairly beaten out of the field. It wasn't an issue of the intellectual at this particular time, nor of the practice, the external practice of religion in England that was the issue. The problem was this, that at the very time when the intellectual basis of Christianity was strongest, and at the time when church attendance was very high, its moral influence was at a low ebb, and that people were not living in ways that were in any way truly distinguishable from the lives of people around them. And it sounds very familiar to our time, where people could be churchgoers, and one in surveys would hardly find much of a difference in their manners and mores from those of the ambient culture, even though they are churchgoers. one looking at their lives and their values and their convictions would be hard-pressed to see a real difference between those who claim to be followers of Jesus and those who are followers of the world system. The only difference was that there would be a kind of a thin veneer applied over the world system, a veneer of religion and of religious practices that were extremely external, not internal. And thus, the title for this book, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life, was very well chosen. It's literally a call to people to live more nearly as they prayed. You pray a certain way, now you need to live in ways that are consistent with the prayers that you say we should have and follow. So his point is that not that you need more knowledge, your problem is that you need more consistency in acting up to your knowledge. So that the problem we have here in this time, and again in our time, is that we can have a tendency to live in ways that are incompatible with our knowledge. We know a great deal more than we live. This is really the issue he's facing. And so my point here is this is one of the reasons why it's a perennial classic, because it really addresses a problem that hasn't gone away since the 18th century, but in fact is, in our time, in great evidence. He was addressing himself then, I want to suggest, to churchgoers. And so his intention in writing this book wasn't so much to persuade them to go to church. So he says very little about that. Instead, he focuses on their home life and on their business pursuits and on their tastes and their aspirations. He comes very close to those issues. He's assuming that they go to church. He's not persuading them to do that. That's not the issue at all. It's a book, then, that has had a powerful influence. For example, in Boswell's Life of Johnson, Johnson said, I became a sort of lax talker against religion, for I did not think much against it, and this lasted until I went to Oxford, where it would not be suffered. When at Oxford, I took up Law's Serious Call, the very book we're going to look at, expecting to find it a dull book, as such books generally are, and perhaps to laugh at it. But I found Law quite an overmatch for me. And this Johnson was no dummy. He was the author of the famous Dictionary of the English Language. This was the first occasion of my thinking in earnest of religion after I became capable of rational inquiry. So he was taken with this book. On another occasion, Johnson called it the finest piece of hortatory theology in any language. Hortatory means exhortation. Sermonic, exhortation to change in life and manners. And he also said it's the best piece of divinity that he knows. John Wesley also, though Wesley disagreed with aspects, of course, of Law's views, nevertheless was still profoundly touched by it and called it a treatise which will hardly be excelled if it be equaled either for beauty of expression or for depth of thought. So also Charles Wesley, calling it the alteration in his views and feelings which were produced by the religious call, referring to those changes in his life. George Whitfield called it a serious influence on his life as well. Others as well, John Newton, made consistent claims that this book was a life-changing event as they read it. Well, this makes some sense, then, if it's been such a powerful effect on the lives of so many great leaders. Maybe it's a good book for us to see today. And it's been in print, of course, consistently for these many years. That's a good sign. Because reading the current book lists in Christian bookstores, how many of those will be in print 200 years from now if Jesus were to tarry? I submit precious few, if any, that are being currently published in the religious bookhouses. This is why it takes a certain measure of time for a book to be truly tested, to see if it's really a classic that will truly endure, if it has that quality. And so we're not looking at something that's not tried and tested. It's something that has had a powerful impact, not only in the 18th century in which it appeared, but then in the 19th and in the 20th, and I believe will continue until Christ comes again. A couple of other comments before we move into this book itself. I mentioned already about the schools and almshouses and so forth. I should mention that this man who was truly a modern saint, and a mystic as well. He's an unusual combination because he had both high church tendencies, but also was attracted to Jacob Boehm and other mystics. And he was unusual, and the Puritan, he had a Puritan touch to him as well, though again, high church and Puritan didn't usually go quite together, but still, there was a connection. He died in the year 1761, very appropriately, singing on with his last breath, practically, the Angel's Hymn. This is a book that's become known not because he was so famous, but because of its intrinsic merit and the sheer power of its own independent greatness. There's a what I'd like to speak of as an inner integrity of the author, that he lived as nearly as he could to the practices. And by all accounts, he was a man who was very consistent with that which he communicated. So he has a spiritual authority. And also, I think another reason why it has been so effective, because it's immensely practical. May I say more than practical, it's downright convicting. Having just gone through this book for the third time, and this time for preparation for tonight, I have to say, I mean, about reading, say, the Epistle of James, reading the Epistle of James will be hard to read if you're alive without being convicted. Would you agree with that? I mean, that's a powerfully convicting book. It's like the preacher, it's like the prophet Amos and the wisdom literature being put together. And James is intensely practical and awfully convicting. Well, imagine 50 books of James tacked on one after another, and you get the impression, this thing will wear you out and beat you up. I mean, this book really will work you over. So I don't recommend it lightly. I think it's a book that needs to be read, and perhaps not too intensely. You don't want to drink from this thing too much all at once. It'll overwhelm you. This is a book that should be read devotionally. A little bit at a time is the best way to go with this sort of literature, because he doesn't waste words, and he doesn't mince thoughts at all. So there's this practicality, a struggle for a profound and far-reaching decision in the life of its reader. It's not theoretical at all. Yes, there's an emphasis on the sterner, the more solemn side of the gospel, but may I say that it's a book that also communicates and conveys a sense of genuine passion and a genuine sense of purpose and place, wants to make us think very clearly about what are the things that truly matter in life. Now, there are 24 chapters, and in the first series of chapters, chapters 1 through 13, we would call the first part of the work. Again, it doesn't call it that, but in effect, what we have in the first part of the work are the importance, the themes of devotion and the importance that it has to our lives. But then, beginning in chapter 14 and going through chapter 24, it has to do now not so much with devotion as it concerns our life, but devotion as it concerns our worship and our prayers. And so it'll be very specific and practical about that. So let's look at the first section of this book now. Let's look at, and I'm just going to pull out some highlights from each of these chapters. The first chapter, whose subheading is Concerning the Nature and Extent of Christian Devotion, he immediately starts off with a theme that's going to run through the entirety of the work, namely, considering God in everything. There's no sacred, secular distinction. He wants us to integrate and consider how this works. And this is why he says that our lives may be of the same nature, full of the same wisdom, holiness, and heavenly tempers, that we may live unto God in the same spirit that we pray unto him. That's a theme that I mentioned earlier. Live in the same way that you pray. May your devotions that you at least mouth at church become real in your lives. Isn't it easy to go to church, to say the creed, to listen to the hymns and sometimes mouth them, even though you're not even really consciously working them into your mind, to go through all those motions and not for them to be real. In him, all the ordinary actions of our life need to be brought under the authority of reason, reason as opposed to folly, not reason as opposed to faith. So that the idea here is that you engage in a reasonable course of action. Now, what he does is he uses a number of names. He invents characters and gives them names and describes them so he can use them both as illustrations of models to be followed, but others to be avoided. The first of these is Julius, very fearful of missing prayers. All the parish supposes Julius to be sick if he's not at church. But if you were to ask him why he spends the rest of his time by humor and chance, why he's a companion of the silliest people and their most silly pleasures, why he's ready for every impertinent entertainment and diversion, he starts coming up. Why is this person one person at church and in prayer, and an entirely different person in his practice? So what we have is a first of a series of portraits that he uses. Sometimes, again, we have a kind of parody, a kind of humor, but at the same time, he manages to convey a practical sense of his points. He says, there cannot be anything imagined more absurd in itself than wise and sublime and heavenly prayers added to a life of vanity and folly, where neither sincere labor nor diversions, neither time nor money, are under the direction of the wisdom and heavenly tempers of our prayers. So this is the theme, he says. Look at your life. Is it consistent with the kind of prayers that you make? It's as great an absurdity to suppose holy prayers and divine petitions without an holiness of life suitable to them as to suppose an holy and divine life without prayer. So he's saying, want to be consistent here. The short of the matter is this: either reason and religion prescribe rules and ends to all the ordinary actions of our life, or they do not. If they do, then it is as necessary to govern all our actions by those rules as it is necessary to worship God. For if religion teaches us anything concerning eating and drinking or spending our time and money, if it teaches us how we are to use and contemn the world, if it tells us what tempers we are to have in common life, how we are to be disposed toward all people, how we are to behave towards the sick, the poor, the old, and the destitute, if it tells us whom we are to treat with a particular love, whom we are to regard with a particular esteem, if it tells us how we are to treat our enemies, and how we are to mortify and deny ourselves, he must be very weak that can think these parts of religion are not to be observed with as much exactness as any doctrines that relate to his prayers. So that's one of his diatribes there. Gives you an example. He doesn't pull his punches. He comes very strongly on this. He talks about how we are called to renounce the world and differ in every temper and way of life from the spirit and way of the world, to renounce its goods, to fear none of its evils, to reject its joys, and so forth. And he discovers this idea and focuses particularly in holy fear, heavenly aspiring after another life, to take up our daily cross, to deny ourselves, to profess the blessedness of mourning, and so forth. The devotion of the common life is what you might call this. He speaks about people who are thus in this situation, who are often at church, pleased with fine preachers, but look into their lives and you see them just the same sort of people as others are, that make no pretenses to devotion. It's one of the points I just mentioned. The differences that you find betwixt them is only the difference of their natural tempers. They have the same tastes of the world, the same worldly cares and fears and joys. They have the same turn of mind, equally vain in their desires. You see the same fondness for state and equipage, so he's talking about their carriage and their horses and so forth, the same pride and vanity of dress, the same self-love and indulgence, the same foolish friendships and groundless hatreds, the same levity of mind and trifling spirit, the same fondness for diversions, the same idle dispositions and vain ways of spending their time and visiting in conversation as the rest of the world, that make no pretense to devotion. You can see the man's not writing to win people and influence others so much, to make friends and influence people. He's writing, though, to make a correction in his own time. He says, there's the condition of the folly of praying as Christians and living as heathens. So that's really the essence of that first chapter, the dilemma of people who pray one way and live another way. We may not agree entirely with how he defines what the spiritual life ought to look like, and there are some cultural factors that need to be taken into account. For example, he wrote a treatise against entertainments and plays and so forth, and my own view would be somewhat different than his along those kinds of line. My own view is that there can be drama and literature and so forth that can be very redemptive and powerful. Be that as it may, though, his point's not to be overlooked. Whether you agree with a specific application, the point is that there needs to be a consistency and a coherence between our belief and our behavior, between our prayers and our lives. Which brings me into the second chapter, what he calls an inquiry into the reason why the generality of Christians fall so far short of the holiness and devotion of Christianity. And again, I'm only going to be pulling little bits from here and there. Here the key word is the word intention. Intention is the essence of this chapter. Having a sincere intention. And so he asks this question, if you stop and ask yourself why you are not as pious as the primitive Christians were, your own heart will tell you that it is neither through ignorance nor inability, but merely because you never thoroughly intended it. He is saying it's not far beyond us. They were not extraordinary people, but rather they were ordinary people who had extraordinary intention and resolve and purpose, courage and fortitude, and desired with all their hearts to esteem the things that God declared to be important. This intention to please God in all your actions as the happiest and best thing in the world is something that he wanted to focus on. And thus talks about a tradesman. If a tradesman have this intention, it will make him a saint in his shop. Now that's a very advanced concept for that time. Because typically, there was this mindset that the clergy were one thing, the laity were another. And that the clergy were the ones who were the professionals. But what he's seeking to do is to empower the laity and to show that the ministry needs to be in the hands of the laity as well. And so his point here is that one can be as much a saint in his shop as a person who is called to be preaching in a church. There is no higher saintliness than one or the other. It's not that there is some kind of a divide between the sacred and the secular. So the issue is a person along these lines with holy intentions doesn't ask himself what's allowable and pardonable, but what's commendable and praiseworthy. In other words, he wants to see how he can best leverage his short time on this planet for eternal gain. So he says, let us judge ourselves sincerely. Let us not vainly content ourselves with the common disorders of our lives, the vanity of our expenses and folly of our diversions, the pride of our habits, the idleness of our lives, the wasting of our time, fancying that these are such imperfections as we fall into through the unavoidable weakness and frailty of our nature. Now, take ownership of what you have. Where you are spiritually is going to be something that, while we need divine grace, there is a synergy, not a monergy. Synergy means that there is a divine human process that's involved. Now he says, this doctrine does not suppose that we have no need of divine grace, so he corrects that false impression, or that it's in our own power to make ourselves perfect. He's not making that claim. It only supposes that through the want of sincere intention of pleasing God in all our actions, we fall into such irregularities of life as by the ordinary means of grace we should have had the power to avoid. So that's his point in that chapter, is the issue of holy intention, which raises the question, what is it that you want more than anything else? And it's an important question to ask yourself from time to time. What is it that I really want? If I were to look back at the end of my life, what kind of life would I wish to have? And those are questions that should be posed from time to time. We move into chapter 3. This chapter, the subtitle, is the great danger and folly of not intending to be as eminent and exemplary as we can in the practice of all Christian virtues. So he picks up on that theme of intention in this third chapter and talks about the idea of the difference between the follower of Jesus and those who are merely professors rather than possessors. If there's nothing about my life and conversation that shows me to be different from the Jews and heathens, if I use the world and worldly enjoyments as the generality of people now do, and in all ages have done, why should I think that I am amongst those few who are walking in the narrow way to heaven? So he gets pretty strong on some of these points here. Speaking of us who were born in the dregs of time, he says, we ought to aspire after holiness to consider not how much will make his present life easy, but to ask himself how much he thinks will make him easy at the hour of death. So this memento mori, remember your death, is this concept that comes across once again, over and over again, and was indeed a major theme in earlier piety, which has been rather lost in our own time. This idea of reminding yourself that the earthly pursuits are very brief and themselves, and they in themselves do not last. I saw Patton recently, saw that again. How many of you have seen that movie, Patton? And you recall that you have George C. Scott turning in a remarkable performance indeed, and at the end of the film, he recalls how a general who returned in triumph would receive accolades, that there would be this triumphal entry, and that there would be the slaves and the captives, and there would be booty and bounty and goods and so forth that would be paraded to show this dignity and glory, and he himself would come in with a chariot, perhaps with his children on the chariot or alongside of him. And in this great and glorious entry into the imperial city, there'd also be another person who would be right behind him, a slave, behind that returning conqueror. And the slave would hold a wreath, a crown over the head of the victor. And he would whisper in his ear as he's going into this triumphal entry into the city, remember that all glory is passing. An interesting practice, that all glory is so don't take, even as he's going in to claim his titles, even now, remember, this is passing. There's an insight, there's a wisdom to that, to gain a mindset of what will really last, what will endure. He talks about a fellow by the name of Penitens. He's not very subtle in some of the names they use, and Penitens is a fellow who was busy, noble tradesman, very prosperous in his dealings, but died in the 35th year of his age. And a little before Penitens' death, when the doctors had given him over, some of his neighbors came one evening to see him, at which time he spoke thus to him. And he gives him this long speech that Penitens gives, where he says it's all too late, that I lived it in vain. And he talks about how, he says, feast and business and pleasures and enjoyment seem great things to us whilst we think of nothing else. But as soon as we add death to them, they all sink into an equal littleness. And the soul that is separated from the body no more laments the loss of business than the losing of a feast. The greatness of those things which follow death make all that goes before it sink into nothing. And so penitence is repentant, but a bit too late. Having repented over a wasted life is the idea here. The thing that now surprises me above all wonders, penitence says, is this, that I never had so much as a general intention of living up to the piety of the gospel. He says, what's the reason I brought none of these tempers to religion? What's the reason that I, who have so often talked of the necessity of rules and methods and diligence and worldly business, have all this while never once thought of any rules or methods or managements to carry me on to a life of piety? And so he goes on to say that it would be how regular, exact, and wise he has been in small matters, which are passed away like a dream, and how stupid and senseless he has lived without any reflection, without any rules, in things of such eternal moment as no heart can sufficiently conceive him. And so his point here is that if one applied the same kind of intention to the bigger matters that one applies with discipline and care to small things, our whole lives would be radically different. But he says few do. Moving into the next chapter, chapter 4, he talks about we can please God in no state or employment of life but by intending and devoting it all to his honor and glory. Consider every place as holy, every part of one's life as a matter of holiness. And so worldly business is to be made holy unto the Lord by being done as a service to him and in conformity to his divine will. So again, don't separate your business practices from your devotion. Your business, the way you operate your business, is part of your devotional life, he says. So there's this strong integration of the two. And that it's important for us then to make the connect. Making his God's glory the whole sole rule and measure of our acting in every employment of life. And so he says, if we could suppose that God rejects pride in our prayers and alms, but bears with pride in our dress, our persons, or estates, it would be the same thing as to suppose that God condemns falsehood in some actions, but allows it in others. Again, he says, it needs to spill over into your lives where you bring all your actions to the same rule as your devotions and alms. In chapter 5, he goes on to speak about persons that are free from the necessity of labor and employments are to consider themselves as devoted to God in a higher degree. At that time and in that culture, there were members of the lesser gentry. And the lesser gentry didn't belong either to the country, to the county families, or to the professions of trades. So what you had here is that they didn't have the responsibilities and the public duties of the class above them. But at the same time, nor did they need to work for their daily bread like the classes below them. So you had a class of people who had an enormous amount of time on their hands. And so his question is, what do we do with that time? His argument here would be that that would be an invitation to a higher level of accountability by virtue of the freedoms and choices and options that you have. But the danger of that kind of life is built in, and namely, it's the danger of self-indulgence and frittering it away so that you can lose your purpose on earth. He says, the more you are free from the common necessities of men, the more you are to imitate the higher perfections of angels. And so he says, you're not going to get away with this. And so he talks about this idea and looks at Serena as one of his characters here and basically speaks of her that if she'd been as concerned about the virtues, the development of virtues, as she was about the external things, life would be very, very different indeed. Enlightening it by meditation, making life tender with love, sweetening it with humility, humbling it with penance, and so forth. So he says, we must do everything as the servants of God. We must live in every place as in his presence. True of all of us, whether we have time or do not have. Everything we do is to be lived as in his presence. He makes this argument. If anyone could show that we need not always act as in the divine presence, that we need not consider and use everything as a gift of God, that we need not always live by reason and make religion the rule of all our actions, the same arguments would show that we need never act as in the presence of God nor make religion and reason the measure of any of our actions. If therefore we are to live unto God at any time or in any place, we're to live in him in all times and all places. So again, he's appealing to a basic consistency, that you are to be a person who acts in a way that's consistent with the new nature that you've been given. This is a concept that he's got. In chapter 6, he goes on to discuss advantages of making wise use of our estates and fortunes, and thus talks about money, and does an enormous amount of meddling in that arena. So I'll pass that chapter and go on to chapter 7. And he there makes a contrast between two women, Flavia and Miranda. You know, Flavia is basically a self-indulgent worldling, and Miranda is a self-denying Christian. I mean, it's almost a parody on itself, but he's trying to make his points clear by coming up with these characters that at least he's using them to illustrate. And he says, for example, of Flavia, she'd be a miracle of piety if she were but half so careful of her soul as she is of her body. A miracle of piety should be. In other words, she's so focused on the bodily impressions and of appealing to fops and dandies, and that she's missing out on the major component of life. He says, if we were to make a real progress in religion, we'd not only abhor the gross and notorious sins, but we'd regulate the innocent and lawful parts of our behavior. That is to say, there are a lot of subtle things that we can slip out. We may avoid the gross things, but still, in subtle ways, fritter away our opportunity. Which brings me to the next chapter, in chapter 8. He talks about the idea of Miranda. And so we go from Flavia in that chapter, and now we're talking about the virtuous woman, Miranda. If anyone is so wise as to think his time too precious to be disposed of by chance, an interesting image that. What he's claiming is there's no time, there's no resource, there's no ability that should be regarded as mere chance. He says it shouldn't be left to be devoured by anything that happens in his way, that ultimately there's a need for the use of our time so that the ordinary actions of our common lives will then be brought under the authority and lordship of Christ. Our time and our money, again, he discusses, and then uses Miranda as an example of a person who pursued the one thing most needful. She doesn't divide her duty between God, her neighbor, and herself, but she considers all as due to God, and so does everything in his name and for his sake. There's no separate division, but there's a unity of vision in her. And then he illustrates that in specific ways that are specifically appropriate to his time and age. In the next chapter, he speaks a little bit more about Miranda and talks about, again, the life that's led wholly unto God and the pursuit of heavenly affections. Even proposes the idea of the formation of, or the connection in some kind of way where there are perhaps little societies or some kind of a connection that was needful in that age for people to have a sense or culture of mutual enhancement and discipline and encouragement. The idea that one could have an accountability group would really be the equivalent of what he's talking about. The need for there to be other people who meet with us where we pray together and consider again the things that truly matter. They didn't exactly have Bible studies in those days so much as they had societies where there would be a common rule of life and where they'd reflect deeply on those kinds of ideas. So the idea here is that there's a need for a corporate dimension as well. In chapter 10, he talks about a character by the name of Fulvius. I like that name. And a person who was very, very focused on education and so forth. But again, he's saying that all orders of life, regardless of how well we are educated, are to be devoted to God's purposes. He that dares not say an ill-natured word or do an unreasonable thing because he considers God as everywhere present performs a better devotion than he that dares not miss the church. That's an interesting and radical claim. So he's saying here, be focusing on the way of consistency. As he says, every sober reader will easily perceive that I do not intend to lessen the true and great value of prayers, either public or private, but only to show him that there is certainly but a very slender part of devotion when compared to a devout life. Now, that's a radical concept at that time. Again, in a culture that supposed that your participation in a church or your attendance in church services was the be-all and the end-all, would need a message that says, no, it needs to be integrated into the fabric of daily life. A soldier or a tradesman is not called to minister at the altar or preach the gospel, but every soldier or tradesman is as much obliged to be devout, humble, holy, and heavenly minded in all the parts of his common life as a clergyman is obliged to be zealous, faithful, and laborious in all parts of his profession. Again, let's get away, he says, from that sacred secular distinction that we pay the professionals to pray and to be holy. That's what they're called to do. And that's a separate calling and intention. And he challenges that idea in his time. Does he hold ministers and lay people to the same standard? He seems to do just that. He seems to do that. I don't see a distinction in what he calls them to do. He calls them to the same uniformity of the intention of the same kind of life. I don't see a distinction in that. What he says is it's not the standard, but it's the way in which you're called, the sphere of your influence will differ. But not the standard. I don't see any distinction there. Which, again, I'm going to argue is a very unusual position for that time. Very, very radical, very, very different. The next chapter talks about the idea of peace and happiness that can actually be the byproduct of this life. I think what he's doing here is he's realizing, as he's been doing some tirades and a little bit of lambasting, that it's needful now to back off and realize, now, I'm not talking about being grim and gruesome here. That there are actually some genuine benefits that accrue to us from doing this. That in fact it leads to a more pleasurable life in the long run than the kind of supposition that the world tells us that its call to pleasure produces. Because the calls to the world's pleasure, he's going to argue, don't really inflame the heart or last, but this is something that gives us a greater peace, a poise, a calm, a perspective, a patience, a fortitude, an ability to move through life with hope and value and purpose. These are great treasures. And again, we could all agree that what people might claim they want, position, power, popularity, prestige, performance, all those kinds of things pale in comparison with three other qualities, namely love, joy, and peace. Just to start with the first three of the fruit of the Holy Spirit. If a person could exchange position, and possessions and popularity and power for love, joy, and peace, there'd be a no-brainer. You see the point? They suppose that those things, positions and people and possession, will lead to love, joy, and peace. Actually, in and of themselves, they do not. But the quality of love, joy, and peace that's the fruit of the Spirit will ultimately lead to the enjoyment of the opportunity one has in this life, so that one leverages that well and uses it wisely as stewards. So he's suggesting really that the pursuit, ironically, of earthly pleasure makes you the author of your own torment, because you pursue through your pride imaginary wants and vain disquiets. You're all afraid and terrified of people's opinions, and you put yourself under the bondage then of the kinds of opinions of society, and there's a foolishness in that. Almost trying to be so extravagant that your whole life is based upon learning how to fly, and you can take the lessons and be diligent, but at the end of the day, it's not even in your nature, and it'll never satisfy you. Or he says, again, if you could see it, this is a homely illustration, but he uses it. If you could see a man that had a large pond of water, yet living in continual thirst, not suffering himself to drink half a draft for fear of lessening his pond. If you should see him wasting his time and strength in fetching more water to his pond, always thirsty, yet always carrying a bucket of water in his hand, watching early and late to catch the drops of rain, gaping after every cloud and running greedily into every mire and mud in hopes of water, and always studying how to make every ditch empty itself into his pond. If you could see him how gray and old in these anxious labors, if you could see him grow gray and old in these labors, and at last end a careful, which means careful, literally, full of care and woe, careful, thirsty life by falling into his own pond. Would you not say that such a one was not only the author of all his own disquiets, but was foolish enough to be reckoned amongst idiots and madmen? That's the kind of grim humor he uses, hyperbole. But frankly, it forces you to do a little thinking about that, because there's a real analogy to the way a lot of people do live their lives. It's as absurd as that. What's patently obvious in the physical realm isn't always so clear in the moral realm. So sometimes the physical analogy makes it clearer. He says, for all the wants which disturb human life, which make us uneasy to ourselves, quarrelsome with others, and unthankful to God, which weary us in vain labors and foolish anxieties, which carry us from project to project and from place to place in a poor pursuit of we know not what, are the wants which neither God nor nature nor reason hath subjected us to, but are solely infused into us by pride, envy, ambition, and covetousness. We become consumed by envy and covetousness, pride and ambition to pursue things that are really not going to satisfy us in the end. And so he is saying that we're placed in a world full of a variety of things. Our ignorance makes us use many of them as absurdly, though, as a man that put dust in his eyes to relieve his thirst or put on chains to remove pains. We're not using the world wisely. We're not handling it correctly. In his next chapter, chapter 12, he talks about the kinds of poor contrivances for happiness as mere inventions. Talks about ambition, for example, that the desire to raise yourself to some imaginary heights above other people. That's an invention of happiness which has no foundation in nature, but as mere a cheat of our own making, as if a man should intend to make himself happy by climbing up a ladder. He goes on to talk about a character by the name of Flatus. Now, he's not getting subtle here at all, about, again, this kind of grim humor about a man who just gives up true happiness by giving himself in exchange for things that will not sustain him. Another character by the name of the kind of gigaw happiness of a woman by the name of Feliciana, and the poor condition of this guy named Succus, who is constantly sleeping and indulgent. So he brings up these characters, and he speaks about these characters in this way. Here's what he's saying. If I were to give you nothing but exemplary characters, you wouldn't be able to relate to them very well. So he's saying, I got to use these crazy characters so we can identify. What he's really saying here is that examples of great piety are not now common in the world. And he goes on to say, to meditate upon the perfection of the divine attributes, to contemplate the glories of heaven, to consider the joys of saints and angels living forever in the brightness and glory of the divine presence. These are the meditations of souls advanced in piety and are not so suited to every capacity. Thus, he says, that's why I'm giving you these homely illustrations. But to see and consider this, the emptiness and error of all worldly happiness, to see the grossness of sensuality, the poorness of pride, the stupidity of covetousness, the vanity of dress, the delusion of honor, the blindness of our passions, the uncertainty of our lives, and the shortness of all worldly projects. These are meditations that are suited to all capacities, fitted to strike all minds, and that's why he does them. He seeks to drive his point home and home again. Chapter 13, which is the last chapter of the first portion of the book, where he talks about the danger not only of a life of vanity, but even the most regular kind of life that's not governed by devotion, shows misery and want and emptiness, even to the eyes of the world. He speaks about learning the greatness of religion from the littleness and vanity of every other way of life, and it uses some characters to discuss that, which I won't go into in this particular chapter. But let me give you an example of another form of humor that he uses, but it's not entirely funny. In fact, it's scary how close it can be to some people's lives. Now, you're going to have to transpose with me here, going back a couple of centuries, to make the connection in this example and the hyperbole he uses. But the principle applies to our time as well. Let us be supposed that Negotius is a character, Negotius. What does that tell you about him? He's all wrapped up in so much business affair that he doesn't really think about the things that might endure. Let's suppose that Negotius was a painful, laborious man, every day deep in variety of affairs, that he neither drank nor debauched, but was sober and regular in his business. Let it be supposed that he grew old in this course of trading, and at the end and design of all this labor and care and application to business was only this, that he might die possessed of more than 100,000 pairs of boots and spurs and as many greatcoats. You catching where we're saying? Let it be supposed that the sober part of the world say of him when he's dead, and that he was a great and happy man, a thorough master of the business, and had acquired 100,000 pairs of boots and spurs when he died. Now, if this was really the case, I believe it would be readily granted that a life of such business was as poor and ridiculous as any as that can be invented. But it would puzzle anyone to show that a man that has spent all his time and thoughts in business in hurry, that he might die, as it is said, worth 100,000 pounds, any whit wiser than he who has taken the same pains to have as many pairs of boots and spurs when he leaves the world. Because the pounds, 100,000 pounds, which was a lot of money in those days, would be no more valuable to him than leaving behind a pile or a mountain of boots and spurs, or whatever you want to call it. You could make it widgets. You could make it anything that a man amasses all that. Reminds me of Uncle Scrooge. Remember Uncle Scrooge there? He had his own treasury house. Remember he built it? And all he does is swim in these coins and these dollar bills that are sticking out. That's real pleasure. I mean, even there, even as a kid, I said, I don't believe I'd be doing that with that money. But that's about as absurd as it is. How little is lost and how much is gained, though, by introducing a different perspective. Now, here's something that does grab me, and I've used this particular quote in Conform to His Image. He speaks about the idea, if it be wise and happy to live piously because we have not above a year to live, isn't not being more wise and making ourselves more happy because we have many more years to come? Now, here he drives a point home. If you knew you only had a day to live, or a year, if you were given a report that you were terminally ill and you had 6 months to a year left, in what way would that affect the way you order your steps in this world? You must be honest. It would affect you in profound ways. All the more if you knew you had exactly 7 days left. If you had 7 days, how would you order your affairs? What would you do that's different from what you do now? If you knew you had but 7 days, what things would you want to set right to prepare for that eternal journey? This is the question he raises. But then he again uses his logic and drives the point home. If 1 year of piety before we die is so desirable, is not more years of piety much more desirable? If a man had 5 fixed years to live, he could not possibly think at all without intending to make the best use of them all. When he saw his stay so short in this world, he must needs think that this was not a world for him. And when he saw how near he was to another world that was eternal, he must surely think it very necessary to be very diligent in preparing himself for it. Now, as reasonable as piety appears in such a circumstance of life, it is yet more reasonable in every circumstance of life to every thinking man. For who but a madman can reckon that he has 5 years certain to come? You'd have to be a madman to be sure. I got 5 years for sure to come. You don't know if you have 5 days to come. And so he says then that this idea, if we're created to be eternal, to live in an endless succession of ages upon ages where thousands and millions of thousands of years will have no proportion to our everlasting life in God, so with regard to this eternal state, which is our real state, 25 years is as poor a pittance as 25 days. On that scale, what's 25 years? Now, we can never make any true judgment of time as it relates to us without considering the true state of our duration. If we are temporary beings, then a little time may justly be called a great deal in relation to us, but if we're eternal beings, then the difference of a few years is as nothing. So he, again, tries to take that logic and drive it home, to cause us to see things in a different way. Now, my time draws near, speaking of time, and I'm only halfway through the book, a little bit more than halfway through. So what I'll do is I'll just pull out just a few of my favorite bits from the back, and it won't be maybe less than 10 minutes to do that. If you need to leave, you can leave. But the second part focuses on times and hours of prayer and won't take me as long to do. But I would suggest that there's an outline where he actually gives a suggestion for kind of our daily rule and the kind of things we could pray. Won't need to go into that so much, but I'll just pull out a few things about this concept of how one might then in their devotional life apply themselves and prepare themselves for the reception of the Holy Spirit and to redeem that time and have true liberty of private devotion. And he offers really a remarkable number of very practical suggestions that were somewhat unusual for his time, keeping in mind that often these kinds of things would be reserved for monks and so forth or for people in orders, which would be called regulars. They were regular Christians, meaning regula from the word rule. They were people who were under a common rule of life. And so people, lay people, were not regulars. They didn't have a common rule. They were not the religious. The religious were people in holy orders. He's suggesting a kind of rule of life that a regular or an ordinary person could have and thus become regular in that different sense. He talks about in your prayers, the first thing you do is to let your soul place itself in the presence of God, a suggestion I'd strongly make, that before you actually open your mouth in prayer or go into silent prayer, he says, pause and become aware of the presence of God. He suggests as well that you pray in the same place, because there's a power in sanctifying a place and setting it apart for that particular use. And that you begin when you're in your prayer with various expressions of the attributes of God. Again, a very wise thing. Rather than beginning with petitions, he's speaking about the idea of preparing yourself for entrance into the presence of God and offers a variety of very specific and practical suggestions that I think are very helpful. Then he talks about the use of scripture or any book of piety. When you meet with a passage that more than ordinarily affects your mind, he suggests then turn it into a form of a petition. Something I strongly believe in, praying scripture back to God, for example. So that as you're reading a text of scripture, something grabs you, or you're reading a devotional book, something speaks to you, stop there. That's an invitation by the Spirit to respond and to make it your own, to internalize that prayer. Again, very practical suggestions. Receive, he then also says, every day is a resurrection from death. And as a new enjoyment of life. Meet every rising sun with such sentiments of God's goodness as if you had seen it in all things new created upon your account. And under the sense of so great a blessing, let your joyful heart praise and magnify so good and glorious a Creator. Don't take life for granted. Have a sense of gratitude, and he just discusses this later. And there are certain suggestions he offers for that as well, that are appropriate to the difference of our state and the difference of our heart and our circumstances. And so he talks about this need then for us to use our time well. And there's a particular passage that struck me. He talks about the problem of negligence from considering what devotion is. If they did but once proceed so far as to reflect about it or ask themselves any questions concerning it, they would soon see that the spirit of devotion was like any other sense or understanding, and that it is only to be improved by study, care, application, and the use of such means and helps that are necessary to make a man more proficient as in any art or science. What he is saying is you become skillful in this area of devotion as you practice. You might have setbacks, you might bore yourself silly, but then you add a new method and some new ideas, you build your sense of skill, a repertoire, and you begin to approach this as you'd approach any skill or practice, and you can gain access into these ways of entering into God's presence more effectively than you could have before. So it's a very important notion that, again, practical. So he talks about devotion, and he defines it as nothing else but right apprehensions and right affections toward God. Right apprehensions and right affections toward God. He has a whole chapter on the chanting of psalms that is quite meaningful to me, and has, again, some very, very helpful ideas in that. And particularly hones in on the idea of thankfulness, which is a theme that I have become very much enamored of, the idea of gratitude. I've become a bigger believer in the idea of gratitude and thankfulness for all things. And there are things one can do to be thankful. Even mental experiments. I tried something the other day that scared me to death. It'll seem so trivial and trite to you, but I tried it out. I don't know what even made me think about it. I said, I'm going to close my eyes for a couple of minutes and do my normal tasks, but without opening my eyes. Drove me nuts trying to hang clothes up and trying to move from into the room. Just to imagine what it would be like to be blind. I couldn't do it for 5 minutes. It was too much for me. I couldn't stand it. How completely reliant I am on my sense of sight and how rarely I appreciate it. You see, taking it as my due, taking it for granted. That was a very eye-opening experience. Get it? Exercise. The same would be true of a number of things. I think a creative way of thinking about ordinary gifts and graces as being gifts of God and having an understanding and an apprehension of life as gift would be go a long way to moving from resentment to gratitude. Resentment because we think of what we don't have. Gratitude being amazed at the gifts of God. That life really, in many ways, is lanyap, as the Cajuns say. It's on the house. It's a grace. It's more than you deserve. It's a perspective. To thank and praise God for everything that happens to us is no easy task. But he suggests that we do this. And so he also suggests, I think, something remarkable, the creative use of one's imagination in our prayers. And so, again, in many ways, the man's very far ahead of his time. And that's one of the reasons I think it speaks to us so much. He recommends prayers for humility as well. He suggests those be used at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'll be honest with you. I can't keep these hours he's talking about. But I can adapt the days. I don't know how one could normally do this. It's almost like taking the monastic rule. For example, at 6 a.m., your prayers should be that of praise and thanksgiving. At 9 a.m., prayers for humility. Then at 12 noon, the sixth hour, universal love with intercessions as an act of universal love. At 3 p.m., the ninth hour, resignation and conformity to the will of God. And then at 6 p.m., self-examination and confession of the sins of the day. And just before bedtime, meditate on death. I'll be perfectly frank with you. I can't just stop everything and do these things, and that's part of the benefit of being a part of an order, of a rule that encourages us and crafts a life that can make that happen. Most of us can't do it, but there's still some things we can do that are of a practical nature that can help us. And being aware of humility, again, some very specific things that are very useful and I thought helpful to me, that can be applied regardless of when and how I offer those particular prayers. Jumping on ahead, just a couple more thoughts. He talks about the need of religious education and has some, I think, profound ideas about religious education, specifically in the area of the cultivation of real virtue. Rather than spurring up all of our industry by ambition, envy, emulation, and desire of glory of distinction. He says we teach kids to and exhort them from corrupt motives. We stir them up to action from principles of strife and ambition, from glory, envy, and a desire of distinction, that they may excel others and shine in the eyes of the world. Don't we do this in education? Then after this, we complain of the effects of pride. We wonder to see grown men actuated and governed by ambition, envy, scorn, and a desire for glory. That considering that they were all the time of their youth called upon to all their action and industry upon those same principles. I'll leave that for you to cogitate on. But it made me think that, you know, there's a lot of truth to what the man says. He's not down...